What's up, Foos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me, about to get them, all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Well, Tony Bruschi is still on his honeymoon, so you got Robin Drake, and you're also going to have Todd with me today, our amazing producer. And so welcome to Hidden Killers Live. I am, as I said, Robin Drake. We're driving the bus for Tony while he's away on his honeymoon, and we're going to be covering a couple big stories today and big twists that came out over the weekend in the last couple days since we've been away. We start off what's going on now with the Rex Heuermann saga, and that is Allison Winter. And if you watch the Hulu doc, or Hulu, what was that on, Todd? I don't think it was on Hulu.
It's on Peacock.
Right. So we're going to be covering this one because if you watch that, and it was really compelling. Matter of fact, we did a deep dive with most of our guests on that one, including the great Siobhan Scott, about the therapist and the work the therapist was doing with him. Well, it turns out the therapist is not quite licensed to do what she did. So let's be talking about that and doing a deep dive. But we're going to be, Eric might be joining us because normally Eric Faddis is our defense attorney and former prosecutor that joins us on Thursdays. He's running a little bit late. Not sure if he's going to make it or not. But in the meantime, since this is such an unusual case, we can do a deep dive on that one. And so let's see where I left off here. Suffolk County Jail. She sat in sessions. This is, what's her face?
Allison Winter.
Allison Winter, she sat in sessions, including around the time of his private confession to Asa in Victoria. And now she's facing 18 felonies, grand larceny, scheme to defraud, and unauthorized practice of a profession for allegedly posing as a licensed clinical social worker and billing insurance companies for more than $60,000 while treating one of the most notorious serial killers in America, as well as the entire family. Eric Faddis is going to break this down legally, so we're going to do the best we can because we are not the legal beagles, but there's so much behavior at play here, and we've covered this case so extensively. So with that, first thing I really wanted to cover was Allison Winter wasn't licensed to practice clinically her social work independently in New York, yet she counseled Rex Heuermann week after week for nearly 3 years. How does someone like that, you think, without a license, get that kind of access inside? Any ideas, Todd?
Well, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking you're the behavior guy, right? And so my question to you, kind of based on that, is if you are Allison Winter and you're in this position, there's a Peacock documentary out there. You are in therapy sessions with a well-known possible serial killer at the time. He wasn't convicted or anything like that. And you know your license is not up to par. Why do you get so involved in it? Isn't this something that a normal person might back away from and say, I probably shouldn't be in this. I shouldn't be in the Google or in the documentary on Peacock. What kind of person is Allison Winter just from that perspective?
Yeah, and you hit a keyword right in there, Todd. A normal person would back away from.
Right.
Because the extreme exposure she put herself out there for personally and professionally, it was compelling. And it really, when I first saw this yesterday, again, I didn't do a deep enough dive on her yet because I'm really interested. Anytime something goes sideways with someone, where they're doing something a bit out of that normal, they give us a wobble in what we're expecting, like she just did. First thing I'm doing is I'm looking at their lives, I'm looking at the people in their lives, and asking myself that question, what inspired them to take this action? Because for some reason, she thought this was in her best interest to do. God knows why, because the amount of exposure that she put herself out to personally and professionally was pretty profound. I mean, I don't know how you walk that back and ever even get licensed again because she's practicing. I mean, she's a complete fraud. Because I mean, now complete fraud is probably not entirely accurate because, as Siobhan said, she seemed to be giving some good counseling. Again, it was edited for TV and whatnot, but she's trained in this. She's just not licensed in this. So I'm wondering what her knowledge level of where she was at on that was as well.
We continue to run into situations where somebody within the story, but maybe off to the side, continually kind of does things, participates in a way that kind of messes things up. And, you know, you can look at the Nancy Guthrie case and you can question Sheriff Nanos and his intentions and his knowledge and ability to do his job. Becky Hill in the Alec Murdoch situation where she did something that turned that trial around and now there's going to be a retrial for Alec. Are we, you know, is this another situation of somebody who was within the circle of the case, but still kind of off to the side, who may have just done something that's going to allow Rex to possibly say, hey, wait a minute, after knowing this, I want to change my plea. I need to redo this thing.
Yeah, that's the real big question in there is the fact that I really wonder that was one of the reasons he confessed, because that's something for his lawyers to really wrestle with on this, is the fact that, all right, he confessed, he pled guilty, and if he can tie that confession to her compelling it, but she's now no longer licensed, I wonder if that does affect any appeal process. Granted, I mean, it's one of the reasons why we had the conjecture he confessed anyways, because they had him dead to rights. I mean, there's really no arguments, because again, his confession was more tied to his legal defense saying he should confess rather than Becky Hill. But at the same time, though, it might be a new lever of influence that they exercise on that. And I mean, it's such a strange thing that happens on this one. There is no doubt.
Look who's joining us this morning. It is Mr. Eric Faddis.
Hey, thank God, because we have so many legal questions on this one, Eric.
Good morning, Eric. How are you?
Yeah, I thought that this wasn't happening because of the honeymoon or whatever, but I'm sorry. So I'm here.
No, hey, dude, it's the first day back. And I figured, you need to cover yourself better, Eric, because the reason you're slightly a little tardy is because you had to dress even more appropriately today.
That's right, Robin. That's right.
You are kicking it. did you have a chance to take a look at what we were talking about with having to deal with Huerman and this crazy therapist?
Very briefly, it was sent to me at 10:59 a.m. Mountain Time. So very briefly, but I'll be ready.
All right, so let me fill you in. So I'll redo the intro a little bit here for you. That way, because I'll dive right into the first question, which is going to be, how do you think this really impacts everything? So basically, here we go. Allison Winter counseled Rex Huerman. And that is, if you watch the Peacock doc, that's his counselor, them both for Asa and him. That's the one that was really predominant throughout that Peacock special. So she canceled Rex and his family for nearly 3 years inside the Suffolk County Jail. She sat in on sessions, including around the time of his private confession to Asa and Victoria. She's now facing 18 felonies, including grand larceny, scheme to defraud, and unauthorized practice of a profession for allegedly posing as a licensed clinical social worker and billing insurance companies for more than $60,000 while treating one of the most notorious serial killers in America. So, Eric, based on your backgrounds of both a prosecutor and defense attorney, you know, she wasn't licensed to practice as a clinical social worker independently in New York, yet she counseled him week after week for nearly 3 years. How does someone without a license, first of all, get that kind of access to him? You know, because isn't that part of the hey, if you're going to go into the jail system and you have to have a reason and all that, or am I wrong?
You're right, Robin. And usually there is stricter vetting in terms of jail visits for high-profile alleged serial killers. The institution is really strict and tight about who can go see these folks, in part because they don't want anything affecting the case. They don't want that person to get contraband, a number of concerns. And so to allow a person in there who is just sort of masquerading as a social worker when they do not have that licensure in that jurisdiction is a bit puzzling. Why, you know, does someone just go in and say, hey, you know, I'm a doctor, let me in and talk to this guy? And they say, oh, sure, right, go right ahead. That just seems like an odd way to do that.
Do you think that was more of a failure of the system, or do you think she was trying to manipulate or cajole her way into? I mean, what do you think the breakdown of that was to allow that to happen? Like, whose fault, or do you think it was mutual, or do you think she took advantage of a system that had a loophole in it?
I don't know for sure. I don't know all of the details, but my apprehension is that she had to present some information to the institution before they would just allow her to go meet with Rex. And so did that presentation contain some falsehoods, some fraudulent representations? It would seem, based on the charges and the reports, that it might have. And so that's certainly on her. On the flip side, the institution does have a duty, and it's really a safety and security concern to know who is going to visit their inmates for what purpose, that they are lawfully accredited to do so. And it looks like those verification measures were not adequately put in place here.
So that kind of brings me down this other path I'm thinking, Eric. So here she is. She, for some reason, before you came out, I was telling Todd, you know, people always will act in their best interest. And it sometimes befuddle us of why they thought that was in their best interest to do things like this. Not just the charges that we just read, but with all the other people involved, all the other victims involved, does she really open herself up to any other civil lawsuits or anything from any of the other victims or anyone else involved because of the role she played in this?
You know, in order to have that kind of civil legal exposure, they would have to show that this allegedly fraudulent conduct caused them damages, that it caused them losses. And usually there has to be at least an economic component of those losses. It can't typically be pain and suffering only. And so I think it might be difficult to kind of show that direct causal link between these alleged fraudulent measures that this non-social worker took and some sort of losses sustained by the families. I think that would be an uphill battle.
Have you ever seen this before in your practice that you've been doing where someone
It's similar. I've seen similar circumstances. So when I was a prosecutor, Robin, we had a case for the unauthorized practice of medicine. And what it was in that case is that the person had their medical license suspended. And they said, the heck with the state, I'm going to continue practicing medicine. And, you know, when they're not licensed, they're not under the same regulatory supervision, bad things can happen. And that person allegedly treated a number of patients because thumbing their nose at the state and that suspension. And so these things happen where professionals try to conduct very high-level professional services without the appropriate state accreditation, without the supervision, without the regulation. And you could be charged with a crime. It's very serious.
It's hard to imagine she was that obtuse that she didn't know what was going on or her licensing, you know, issues that she had. Do you think that she was playing or could be playing on some sort of loophole that was in there or she wasn't? I mean, in other words, what would compel her to think this was a good idea?
You know, people charged with crimes are not always the most rational folks.
Yes,
and, you know, perhaps she saw dollar signs. Perhaps she saw fame. Perhaps she saw some kind of payoff to her and concluded that, hey, I've got the chops to engage in this kind of interaction with this person, to elicit this information from an accused serial killer, which might be, which I might use for any number of reasons. And so those sorts of motivations can override a person's reason and caution and prudence if that person has any to begin with.
Yeah. And so right there in the Peacock documentary, she's right there as a family confronts the truth. Legally, does her unlicensed status open a door for Huerman or his family to go challenge anything that comes across from those sessions that she had?
Good question. I'm not 100% sure on that. My thinking would be that there are physician-patient privileges. Some states have physician-therapist privileges, whereby you can't confide in a therapist some incriminating information, then have that therapist go tell the world without your consent. Now, the fact that they weren't a real therapist or a real licensed social worker at the time, I don't think that vitiates the reason behind the therapist-patient privilege. And I think that Rex could have some kind of remedy for, you know, disclosing these alleged secrets in what he thought was sort of a confidential environment when lo and behold, this person was not a licensed therapist. And so it's possible that he could try to take some measure.
Yeah. And so let's flip it to your defense attorney hat on this one. So going down that road, if you're his defense attorney, knowing that this pretty egregious transgression just happened, what's the first steps you're doing and exploring? Does this help an appeal process? Does it negate anything? I mean, what are you doing as a lawyer with your client in this moment?
You know, it's so tough, Robin, because of Rex's decision to enter the guilty plea. When a person is convicted at trial, then there's an appellate review, and the defense can bring out everything under the sun. They could say, hey, you know, just like this, he thought he was talking to a licensed social worker and he was duped. He was conned into providing this information. But on the flip side, when a plea is entered, that is much more sacrosanct. That is much more difficult to challenge. And so these sort of complaints like, oh, I feel like this person duped me and I don't like that. An appellate court's not going to give that any weight at all. Undoing such a guilty plea is immensely difficult, and I don't think that this is going to give Rex any traction.
Would Rex have any traction if he said, listen, I was in these therapy sessions, and in my conversations with my therapist, that's where I decided that I was going to take the plea of guilty? Does he have anything with that at all, or is that still just way out of line?
Gosh, you know, my thinking, Todd, is that that is not going to be his saving grace here. Even though, you know, a person is entitled to a legal process devoid of constitutional errors, but they're not entitled to a perfect legal process. And errors happen like all that. The time. And so long as they are not of a constitutional magnitude and do not justify overturning what was already finalized at the trial court level, he's not going to be able to, this is not going to be some sort of Hail Mary where he's going to all of a sudden be free. No way.
He kind of screwed himself by confessing and pleading guilty, maybe.
Or doing all the things that he did. He kind of screwed himself by doing that.
Well, that's beside the point. Yeah. But I mean, just legally on the appeal process. So last kind of question on this one, Eric. That is, so the prosecutors say that she billed Cigna and United Healthcare and Medicare for tens of thousands of dollars in this insurance fraud. Or does the fact that she was treating a serial killer while in license make it something worse than that, just on the insurance fraud side, do you think?
I think that in terms of insurance fraud cases, this one's going to be looked at really severely. You know, we have sort of this scourge of fraud federally and locally and everything else in our country. And when we're talking about someone who is, you know, it's really manipulating the process in a way that manipulates people. It's not just sort of, you know, filing some paperwork and getting some money wrongfully. It's manipulating a human being, even if it's Rex Herrmann, even if it's a human being who's unpopular. It's playing with their emotions. It is deceiving them. And I think that those types of insurance fraud cases are taken much more seriously than, oh, this person filled out some paperwork wrong and got some money.
I can't even imagine what was going through her mind, and going through her mind now is she just totally hosed herself over, which could have been, you know, I think a really good moment in her professional and personal career of what she was doing, especially, you know, on the path of trying to help Asa back from the brink of crazy town and living in his bedroom that she remodeled. Anyway, life is stranger than fiction sometimes. Your thoughts and comments in the section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Links are in the description. Make sure to like and follow wherever you get your podcasts. Anyway, on to the next one. Still in the same case, we're still talking about the Herrmann case and the family sessions. The therapist who heard Rex Herrmann confess to 8 murders and helped facilitate those family meetings is now a defendant herself. The Peacock documentary put those raw sessions on camera. Now the woman at the center of them faces prison time for practicing without a license. Eric Faddis walks us through whether this creates any legal openings for Herrmann, potential challenges to the plea, or fallout for Asa and Victoria's public statements. So with that, kind of diving back in on this, Huerman confessed to his ex-wife and daughter during sessions involving Winter. If she wasn't legally qualified to be there, could that confession or those family statements be attacked in any future proceeding? We kind of covered this on the last segment, but let's do another little deep dive on that and any other nuances you've thought of.
You know, I see Huerman's attorneys looking at this and saying he pled guilty because he... In large part, because he gave a confession. And at that juncture, he knew, man, it's lights out. It's over. I've told people this stuff. You know, there might be some kind of privilege or protections, but I'm worried this is going to get out. They're going to subpoena my wife and my daughter. And this is going to be a huge problem for my family. That's the reason I'm going to go ahead and plead guilty. If that reason is then taken out from under them because that confession was elicited in a fraudulent and deceptive fashion, does that undercut the motivations behind entering a plea? And does that change in those circumstances and those motivations underlying that plea entitle a defendant to say, hey, I wouldn't have done this otherwise. I wouldn't have pled guilty if this confession wasn't wrung out of me in some sort of conned fashion by this con woman. That could be an argument we see on appeal. I'm not sure how successful it'll be, but that would be a creative avenue.
Yeah, I'm also curious, Eric. So now that she wasn't licensed during all these sessions, does HIPAA still, kick in for her? In other words, is there any privileged information anymore from any of these conversations? In other words, can all these things be opened up now to scrutiny because she wasn't a practicing clinician? I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? Or can he claim some sort of thing against her for that?
You know, Robin, let's say that, let's say Todd goes to somebody whom he believes is an attorney, and Todd confesses to all the horrible stuff he's done over his life.
And, bad Todd.
I'm kidding. He wouldn't have anything to confess. He's a saint. But let's hypothetically say he did. And then it turns out the person to whom he was speaking is just some Joe Schmo off the street. It's not an attorney. So typically when you confide an attorney, when you give secrets to an attorney, that's protected. There's confidentiality and there's a privilege, meaning the attorney can't testify against you. But if that individual is not an actual attorney, does that privilege apply? Does that confidentiality apply? You know, the policy reasons behind that privilege would indicate yes. The policy reasons are we want folks to be able to confide in these professionals for their own, sometimes their own legal protection, sometimes for their own recovery from whatever issues they're contending with. That person would have the same expectations, regardless of whether the individual to whom they were confiding was an actual licensed whatever. But would the law see it that way? I haven't seen such a case come up. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if it did come up, if a judge said, hey, we're giving you the privilege and the confidentiality anyway, because you expected that this person was legit. They weren't. That's not your fault, bro.
So no lemon law, like buyer beware of the unlicensed clinician that made her way in.
Yeah, I don't think it's like, you know, you have to confirm the credentials and their active status of a person in whom you're confiding before that privilege and confidentiality protections can apply. I don't think that burden is on the individual going to some professional for help.
So that burden of providing credentials and verifying credentials, that falls on the jail? Who's that fall on?
Yeah, it falls in part on the state, and they have determined that no such credentials existed according to them, and so they brought criminal charges. In terms of allowing the visits, allowing these things to happen, I'm not sure that the burden squarely falls upon anyone. I think it's just sort of a fluid situation in which there might be shifting responsibility among multiple parties and to varying degrees.
That's really interesting, isn't it? It's like one of the greatest examples of social engineering we've seen in a while. I mean, even in the FBI, just you talk about what people are willing to do over a phone. I mean, I would part of my collateral duty. So I was a spy hunter, interviewer, you know, all the hooky spooky spy stuff and everything inside the bureau I did for years, running the behavioral team. But collateral duties we would get taskings from headquarters. So, because I'm in the Northern Virginia area, DC area. So anytime there's a new elected official, a new president, their appointees go through background clearances, you know, for appointments. And so we have to do a lot of security interviews for people to get clearances, you know, for the entire cabinet, other staff members. And so typically, you know, you want to have someone show up at your doorstep, show your FBI credentials. Although, I mean, even how do you, I mean, it says FBI credentials. I mean, mine are behind me right there. Those are my retired ones back there. People would just take it for granted that you are who you say you are. I would actually call people on the phone. So here's the way I would allow people to verify this on the phone, which is even more unofficial. I'd call them on the phone and say, listen, my name's Robin. I work counterintelligence in the local office here at the FBI. I'm doing a background investigation for so-and-so going for an official government position. Would you mind to talk to me for a few minutes about their background, what you think of them, if that's something you're comfortable doing? If not, here's a phone number, or you can look it up on your own. You can call the Richmond office of the FBI, ask for me, they'll direct you back to me, and you can do that to verify who I am. That's all it took, and people would spill their guts. Now, who's liable in the situations like that? Is she obviously she's liable, and she's being found guilty of this? But I mean, brings up that really interesting question, especially when you're dealing with such high stakes things like someone's life, your life in prison. About who verifies they are who they say they are?
Totally, and you know, you think about Robin. If this person was not a licensed social worker, they could have been anyone. Couldn't they have been, you know, a gang member trying to recruit Rex Hurlman to do horrible things inside of a facility? That's a problem for the facility. That's a problem for the other inmates. Could they be, who knows, an escape artist who is going to try to help break Rex Hurlman custody? There are just unlimited concerns when it comes to the lack of verification in terms of this person's identity.
So we know that, and I want to go back to Alec Murdoch. You know, he's suing Becky Hill, all that kind of stuff. Rex Hurlman can't turn around and say, hey, I'm going to sue this individual for playing the part of a licensed therapist on TV, but not actually being one. He doesn't even have that amount of ammunition in his back pocket.
He might have some kind of legal claim against the social worker. He would have to prove that he was fraudulently induced into disclosing private facts, and that disclosure caused him damages. Certainly it caused him reputational damages. Were some of the damages impairment of his criminal case because he thought, oh, the confession's out there. One form or another, it's out there. And that's, I've got to plead guilty now. I'm screwed. I was already screwed. I'm even more screwed now. You know, could there be such a claim against, could Rex have such a claim? I think he probably in theory could pursue such a claim. Not sure how far it'd go, but possibly.
Talk about claims. Now, Asa's and Rex's daughter, Victoria, she was a teenager during many of the later murders, and she sat in these sessions with an unlicensed therapist. Could this give her any civil claim against the county or Winter herself, you think?
You know, it would depend in part on the county's involvement, the institution's involvement. For example, Robin, if in arranging this whole thing, there was a jail official and they called up Victoria and they said, hey, look, we've got a licensed social worker here. We want to try to have this candid discussion about some really tough stuff. Would you be willing to come in? You know, this person is trained and they know what they're doing. And would you be willing to do that? If that was an inaccurate representation in terms of that to which they were inviting Victoria, I think Victoria could feel rightly aggrieved that, hey, I was duped into coming in here in something that's extraordinarily painful and private for my family, and that might even hurt my dad's chances in the criminal case. But I came because I was told by the institution that this was all on the up and up. I think under those circumstances, she might have a claim against the institution for negligent infliction of emotional distress or some similar claim. And I think that could be viable, but it really depends on what the institution, the positions they had, the representations they made to the family.
Yeah, and also part of Hurlman's plea deal was also cooperation with the FBI's BAU. And do you think that this revelation impacts that at all, or
or anything moving forward with what he's going to share?
Yeah, you know, gosh, if I was him, I'd probably be a lot more cautious. I'd say, hey, the last time I opened up about the most secret and serious thing in my life, I was completely misled. I was taken for. And I don't want that to happen again. That's a crummy feeling for anybody, even if you're a serial killer. It's a crummy feeling for you, too. And so is that going to make him more cautious when it comes to such conversations in the future? Yeah, in this future, yeah, they say it's the FBI and they say that it's going to be, you know, essentially intellectual and scholastic, academic and not investigative. But I've been lied to before, man. So could this have a chilling effect on the information Rex Hurlman brings forward throughout the remainder of his life? I fear that it could. And that'd be a detriment to the FBI. It'd be a detriment to behavioral science. It'd be a detriment to public safety.
Yeah. So, you know, playing that one forward a little bit. So does her actions then, either legally or definitely mentally for Huerman, undermine that plea deal, the fact that cooperation because of this in any way? And if he does withhold information, or even the perception of withholding information and the transparency which he agreed to with BAU, does the FBI have any legal recourse then against Winter?
Yeah.
I ask you brain twisters, man.
You know, I don't think the FBI would – I don't think there's any such claim for, like, tortious interference in FBI investigation. Now, there are charges for obstruction, for interference in governmental operations, things like that. And could this non-social worker's actions stymie some future investigation? I guess that is possible. But I think it's really just a big mess for which there are not many great legal remedies for anybody.
Yeah. And so during this entire thing, right at the sentencing, the judge during sentencing called Huerman disgusting and had him removed. If Winter's credentials do come under fire as they have, does it undermine the whole therapeutic process that led to the plea, do you think? And what do you think? Can you imagine any world where this becomes a kind of new case law on how they verify credentials going into prisons? Or has this happened so frequently that they just ignore it?
You know, gosh, if I'm defense counsel on a case and someone comes to me and they say, hey, we want your client to engage in this therapeutic process, we think that it might make it more likely that we reach a resolution in the case, but he needs to be open and everything like that. I am a lot more vigilant at this point. I am a lot more skeptical and distrustful of the state. There was a comment here by Lorna in 1969 about just losing faith in the system. My gosh, you want to talk about for whom should there be the highest security clearance measures taken in terms of inmates? Well, probably a nationally publicized serial killer who's alleged to have killed at least 8 people. Yeah. And then those protections totally fail in a case like this. Gosh, I'm not so inclined to subject any client to such a purportedly therapeutic process, especially if the last time it wasn't even a real therapist.
Yeah. Last question on this one before we start moving on, Eric. So, because I'm really fascinated by this aspect of it was privileged information from these interviews in the past. Now, granted, if he had disclosed any other murders or anything he had done, she would have be compelled to share that anyway, correct? Even if, you know, if she was licensed or unlicensed, correct or no? Because where I'm getting at is, do investigators now have a more free hand to go and request her journals, her logs, her notes, and go through those and to see what other kind of leakage might be in there to other things he might have done in other states, say North Carolina or something like that, or in Vegas?
Yeah.
Is it protected because she was posing as a therapist?
I would tend to think that it's protected because she was posing as a therapist. Now, the government might disagree. The government might say this protection applies to therapist. She's not a therapist. Therefore, the protection does not apply. Whereas defense is going to say this protection applies to the therapeutic context, and it's based on the patient's expectation of privacy and confidentiality. And so that would be a fight in court. And, you know, could the government authorities get their hands on such records, not call the therapist to testify against Rex and not but then use that information to develop further leads, to try to develop independent bases right. of that information because they were able to acquire it because she's not a therapist. It wouldn't be the first time that such actions were taken. And if the government had like an independent, separate basis, separate and apart from this therapeutic context for the same information, I think that information might be fair game.
Yeah. Does it become fruit of the poisonous tree if they later determine that they couldn't have taken information from there that led to other information that was other crimes or anything? Or, I mean, and I know this becomes really complicated, doesn't it?
It's only fruit of the poisonous tree if the poison originated with the government. And this Winter person right. was not a government employee, is my understanding. She's just a fake private social worker. And so that constitutional argument, fruit of the poisonous tree, can really only be lodged when there is significant government action that really from which the poison originates. So they have to.
This is definitely, you know, every time we think one case is done, something springs new and keeps us going on. And this will definitely keep us interested in what's going on and where they go from here. Anyway, your thoughts in the comments section of Substack and YouTube. Give us your thoughts and opinions. We'd love to hear from you. The links are in the description. So moving along. Next, I want to really dive deeper on what we've been seeing with the David case, because things have gotten really interesting because Hulu just put out a new doc. So to kind of catch everyone up, a status conference just wrapped up in the D4VD case as David, the singer charged with first degree murder in special circumstances in the death of 14-year-old Celeste Rivas Hernandez. While the courtroom moves slowly, social media is on fire, and Hulu just dropped a documentary that dives into the alleged relationship. I just finished watching it last night. It was kind of everything we knew, but a little more shocking because they actually had investigators really spilling their guts on it and, to me, showing some real bias on it. But we'll dive into that in a second. Anyway, Eric Faddis joins us, breaks down what actually happened at the latest hearing, how pretrial publicity and the doc could really affect jury selection, and whether the defense team can use any of this to their advantage. So starting with that background, Eric, the status conference just happened. These hearings are usually about discovery and scheduling. What key fights, again, if you had a chance to catch up on it, I understand if not, we can just talk about everything else around it on Crazy David. What key fights are you thinking are likely playing out behind the scenes right now?
Well, gosh, Robin, there's a lot more ammunition on the defense side now with social media than there was before. And what I mean is that, let's say it's a case 1975, and you know, you have publicization of cases then. You got newspapers, you got TV, and that might affect some potential jurors. But here, now that we have social media, you know, if I was defense, I would be hiring a digital forensic expert to do a broad assessment. How many impressions have stories negative to my client got? And how many of those impressions can we tell are reasonably located within California where they want to bring this trial? Millions, probably tens of millions at this point, I'd imagine. And does that give the court concern about whether a juror can be fair and impartial? You know, you can ask the specific jurors, hey, did you personally hear about this? But just in terms of this broad swath of publicity around cases, negative publicity, prejudicial to the defendant, I think it's going to be a huge fight in terms of, can we really have a fair trial in California? Or do we have to move this to some, you know, small jurisdiction where David might even have a better shot?
You know, it was really shocking to me because I looked up who was actually on this doc and how they portrayed the information. So it was Scott Williams, was LAPD. He's a detective investigator involved in the case. He was interviewed on the doc. And then Nathan Hockman, also LA's district attorney, also appears discussing the charges and evidence. And typically when I've seen cases like this where there's been document, I mean, just we're just talking about Huerman, you know, and so we saw some people testifying on that, and we saw the, you know, the fake therapist doing things like that. But what really struck me was, again, the verbal leakage I saw was very, very damning, I thought, for David. Granted, I mean, the evidence is pretty overwhelming, but again, there's no open and shut cases, you know, as you very well know more than anyone else as a defense attorney. But I would think that that would impeach them, although when I did a research on it, maybe not. So, I mean, what compels someone to do that? And what's a, like, what's, how's a judge handle that when you have two people that are going to be testifying? Seemingly, again, context is everything. From my context, had a definite bias when presenting information for public consumption like that.
Yeah, you know, a couple issues come up with that. Certainly, it's fodder for cross-examination once we get there. You know, oh, Mr. Detective, you were asked to be in this Netflix documentary, and you were really giddy about that, right? You know, millions of people would see your face, and your work would be validated, and so you wanted to present it in a really compelling fashion, didn't you? You know, I think there are just ways to show that these folks allegedly could have a personal interest in what's happening, and you know, could that cause a person to have a motivation to fabricate, to exaggerate, to put things in a certain way that's prejudicial to the defense because it looks cool for them in the Netflix series. On top of that, you know, prosecutors cannot make extrajudicial statements about a case that are prejudicial to a defendant generally. And usually that ethical rule applies to people in the prosecutor's employ or who are working under the prosecutor in that case. And so does the prosecutor have some duty to curtail their investigative team's public statements about a case that might be prejudicial to a defendant? I think they might. And I think that that could be an issue as well going forward.
So it's interesting. Go ahead, Todd. You had something first?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, there's a lot of people around David during this time. He's got a large entourage. And for the most part, it seemed like most of them were very, very loyal. We did know that Neil Langston ended up in the grand jury trial or the grand jury and seemed to have turned on David. My question, Eric, is we've got this going on with David right now, but there may be some other people involved. When do you think, and this case, by the way, really stayed under covers. We didn't hear a lot about it until it was finally charged and all that kind of stuff. And all of us on the outside were going, what's going on with this thing? We'd like more details. Is it possible that there could be other charges coming for some of the people around David? And if so, is that going to wait until this goes to trial and maybe David gets convicted and then more charges come out? Or could they come out at the same time over the next several months?
Yeah, a keen insight there because, you know, you typically don't buy two chainsaws for one person to wield in both hands. Usually, if there are two chainsaws, there are two people wielding them. And I just think that there are a number of circumstances like that in the allegations that suggest that David didn't do this by himself. And so in terms of the sequencing and timing of that, Todd, that would typically happen before David's trial. In fact, they would want to charge those folks and then either offer them immunity or some kind of plea deal to testify against David to strengthen their case against whom they believe is the head honcho in all of these horrible alleged circumstances. And so I would expect that to come out before David's trial as opposed to after, but you got to have the goods. And, you know, they waited a while to charge David in this case. Perhaps they are just being overly diligent, overly thorough. Perhaps there is some other reason for the delay. Hard to say, but not surprised there's been a delay.
How far down the ladder could this go? I mean, if somebody was actually involved with the murder or the disappearance of Celeste, that's one thing. But how far down the chain could charges come? People know about it. People were suspecting it. What are those levels?
Sure. So simply suspecting a person of a crime without more, it would not result in you being charged with a crime. But there are charges for accessory after the fact, for concealment, for obstruction of an investigation, obstruction of justice. And so, for example, if a person had reason to believe that David did this and the cops came to him and was asking him questions, and that individual like tried to throw the cops off of the trail or gave false information, attempting to influence a public servant, there are a panoply of different potential criminal charges that could be levied depending on what the alleged conduct is. But I would be shocked if there was not at least one more culpable actor in this entire saga, just based on, you know, dragging a human being's body to a place where it is going to be disarticulated. And then, you know, I just don't think one person alone did all this.
Yeah. And part of that too, Eric, you know, we have the murder charges, obviously, but, and it's documented, and this is what the Hulu doc covered too, you know, it's very well through text messaging and other forensic evidence they got, they started their sexual relationship when she was a minor. At 13 years old is when it started. And she's traveling with him, part of the entourage. I know we've covered before on shows, but does then, how does someone not be culpable or becomes culpable of that knowledge that makes them an accessory or not an accessory?
Yeah, so very fair question, because, you know, if you see your buddy and he's this superstar and he's hanging out with a 13-year-old girl and he's an adult, anybody would have their eyebrows raised there and say, what's going on here, man? Simply possessing that suspicion is probably not enough. However, if you then aid in some kind of material way, if you, you know, for example, if you see that Celeste's parents calling and you hang up the phone, or you know, you see him calling David's phone and you click, you know, terminate that call or whatever, something like that could be enough to suggest that the person had knowledge that some criminal activity was going on and aided or tried to conceal it rather than some other action. That's where you get into potentially murky territory criminal.
Yeah, I can see murky territory, definitely, because of his digital footprint, because he's so connected digitally, and because, and this kind of morphs into my question about this prejudicial, you know, optic that the judge will have or not have. It's like, how do you rule on that when you have on the dock, again, they didn't say whether they thought he was guilty or innocent, but they very clearly said that David had on his cell phone the proof that they had the underage, you know, relationship, and they said he had child porn on his cell phone when they found it. And so when you present, you know, that a position of authority with that knowledge without a defense attorney arguing against what it could be, doesn't that become prejudicial or not?
Oh gosh, well, sure. And I think the information allegedly on his phone is so damning. You know, everyone before that came out, everyone was like, what in the world is this adult doing with this like 13-year-old girl? That seems pretty suspicious. What's going on? And then I think the revelation of the alleged evidence found on his cell phone cleared that up for a lot of folks in terms of what David was interested in. And that's assuming that this evidence is what the government says it is. I haven't seen it personally, so I can't say.
Right. But, and I'm sorry, Eric, that's the key, is that you keep saying that beautiful word modifier, allegedly. On the doc, they didn't use that word. And that's why I found it. I mean, so you give, you know, the world of maybe out there, which can, so you allow people to do their jobs. But this show did not give a maybe in there whatsoever.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that is, you know, I think during jury selection, they're going to be asking all these folks, hey, have you seen this documentary? You would agree that in the documentary, they affirmatively, conclusively state basically that David is a pedophile. And you realize that this alleged victim is 13 years old and he was an adult, right? And does that give you some concerns about being a juror in this case and things like that? And I think that it gives the defense a lot of grounds to kick jurors who have seen that, who have seen that documentary. And it's going to make it a lot harder for the judge to determine, is this the appropriate venue in which to have this, or do we need to go to some Amish community or something? And I'm talking kind of facetiously, but a lot of exposure in terms of this.
Be an interesting jury. I got a question for you, Robin. Watching that documentary, when you listen to the people who spoke with and were around David when he was younger, A lot of good things said about him. Kind, yeah. Very, very polite, and also God following. Yeah. Were you surprised at that? And then also, do you feel like that was it all just a front, or was there some evolution from David back in Texas to what he became when he was in Los Angeles?
Yeah, it's a great question, Todd, because when I was watching that doc, I was actually kind of surprised at what I saw, because to your observation, he looked pretty well adjusted. He was right. Saying all the right things, and but we had a wobble there. You know, I do these behavior tells in this wobble. The wobble was the lyrics of his song, which I know a lot of people and artists will do different things, say different things, and create their art in different ways. So that was, like, to me, I focused on that. Wow, that's an interesting wobble about how his lyrics are so dark. So to me, I saw the potential of that undercurrent. But had I not known about what he wound up accused of doing, because we're still using that world of innocent until convicted or proven guilty, I was kind of surprised but again, you got editing, you have Hulu. So there was, to me, watching that doc, there's missing pieces of that life that he was portraying if it plays out the way it was. Because he seemed like a pretty normal, well-adjusted, healthy individual until things weren't. So I'm really curious.
I mean, there were people in the documentary, the interviewers, who were like, he was so cool that afterward I took a selfie with him.
Yeah.
I mean, that was almost verbatim.
The newscaster, yeah.
Yeah. I've got a question for Eric. We got the preliminary hearing coming up on the 21st, right? What does that look like for the judge that day? What does it look like for the prosecution and David's defense? Is there any possible way the judge says there's not enough here to take this to trial?
I think there is a possibility of that, Todd, and that's really the exception rather than the rule. And here's why. So preliminary hearings are an opportunity for the judge to determine, is there enough evidence to bump this case over to the trial phase? That threshold of enough evidence is just probable cause. That's just, are there reasonable grounds to believe that he committed this crime? But in this case, there are some questions as to where the crime was committed, who was there, who was wielding the death instrument, how did this happen? Can we rule out an accident? Can we rule out, an overdose, things like that? I think that those questions are still in play. Certainly the government has answers that they believe are true, but I'm sure that we're at a conclusive point on some of those questions. Now, I think the judge is likely to bind the case over for trial, but I think this one, there's at least a little better chance for the defense that they might win at the preliminary hearing. And even if they don't win, you still get benefits of a preview of the prosecution's case. What's it going to look like? What do they think's important? How do their witnesses testify? What weaknesses might those witnesses have? These are all tidbits you get on the defense side from the preliminary hearing, even if you lose, which 99% of the time you lose.
And we haven't really heard much pushback at all from David's defense team yet on this. Are you surprised by that, or do you think they're waiting? What do you think the strategy is?
Yeah, I think it makes sense for the defense on this one especially to wait and see what the government has, because the allegations are so inflammatory. Anybody who hears them, it's not only is it murder of a child, but it's also SA of a child. Anyone who just hears the charges are like, oh, like that's horrible. But do they really have the beef to back it up? Can they really substantiate the elements of this murder happened on this date? It happened this way. We can put the death instrument in David's hands or something. Or do they not have that? And we'll learn at the preliminary hearing more about what they have. So if I was defense, I would be playing things close to the vest, and I would be looking to counterpunch, and I would be saying, hey, let's see where these holes might be. And then once we identify them, we can try to open those up.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what holes they try to poke at from the guy who bought online two chainsaws, a pool, a burn box, and bags, body bags for lawn waste, I guess. Eric, fascinating conversation. There's a lot more to come on this case. Make sure you hit like and follow wherever you get your podcast. That's going to be a wrap for today, folks. Check out Hidden Killers Live tomorrow at 11 Central when we'll be joined by retired FBI agent Jennifer Coffendever. Until then, for Eric, for Todd, for Tony, who is on vacation, still on his honeymoon, I'm Robin Dreek with Hidden Killers Live. Back again real soon. Have a great day.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Plus, terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.